It's no secret that Kansas City still bears the scars of redlining, blockbusting, and segregation in general. But it's not exactly something you want to bring up at a party either. Well, I do, but most people don't. So what's another way to have these conversations and heal the divides? A local poet recently gave a TED Talk on his idea. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson in for Gina Kaufman. And here with me is Glenn North. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning.
You know, I think in a story that I quoted you on, I referred to you as a black culture savant. Because you really are the go-to person that I know I go to all the time, the KCUR goes to. And, you know, people are going to start talking because I feel like you and I are always having these conversations.
Right, right.
And I love them. They should just give us our own talk show, right? You know,
that would work for me. that is a hefty title to bear. I don't know that I would refer to myself as that, but I do know that I love black culture. And so it's important to me to express that through my poetry and through the work that I do.
I do get that. I do get that. But, you know, I have a story running tomorrow where I interview a gentleman who is a historian who's almost 86 years old. And you and I are the same age.
Mm-hmm.
And I see you at 86 being
same
way. You know, because, you know, these conversations are important. So, you know, recently you did a TED Talk on how black cultural institutions are places for racial healing. Is that a accurate, fair way of putting that?
Well, we were all given a theme. There were about seven of us that were given a specific theme. And the theme was healing communities. And I was trying to think in terms of my personal experience, where have I seen community healing take place? And the answer is pretty obvious. It's been in the spaces that I've worked in over the past 15 or so years.
So let me just start with a little basic. I mean, I think most people know what a TED Talk is, but could you just like real briefly explain what that is?
Well, TED stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design. And it's about 30 years old, but these 18-minute talks that people give on various topics that relate to those three categories. And it is, you know, I'm pretty sure that most people are familiar, but you're given about an 18-minute window based on whatever theme or topic you've been asked to discuss. And you're asked to do so in a very polished, succinct manner, without notes. And although I never quite get totally comfortable speaking in front of people, although I do it a lot, there's always still a little bit of nervousness, but you get used to it. But that was a different experience. It was it took a lot of preparation to be able to go for 18 minutes without hemming and hawing a lot or without forgetting what it is that you had planned on saying during the course of those 18 minutes. But I think they're very important because they provide opportunities for education and innovation and access to ideas that people all over the country or all over the world have that I think are very informative, and they're very popular for a reason.
Yeah, I've done a TED Talk for Wyandotte County, and oh my God, the whole talking for 18 minutes without notes, that does take a lot of prep, is to make sure you stay on point and on track. And listening to this TED Talk, you know, to me, you're always on point, you're always on track, and you always do this awesome job of weaving in your art with your great perspectives on what you're talking about, and this was no exception.
Thank you.
For those who haven't listened to your TED Talk, there's something in it that was such an interesting, provocative example you used about how there were, first of all, tell me your background with the Jazz Museum before I ask you about that.
Sure. So I started working at the Jazz Museum back in 2004. And in the TED Talk, I talk about being the accidental docent because it wasn't like I had set out to have a career in museums or black cultural institutions. But I had been doing a poetry reading in the district that I started back in 97 called Verbal Attack, and it had gotten pretty popular. And so the folks at the Jazz Museum asked me to do a series of workshops that explore the relationship between jazz and poetry. And those workshops went very well. A lot of students who would not have otherwise come to the Jazz Museum were in attendance. These were students who might not have necessarily been interested in learning how to play an instrument or what have you. And it just led to me getting hired there. And once I started that work, it just felt like a really good fit for me. So I was there for almost 10 years.
Oh, wow. I understand about accidental paths that completely change your life. But you talk about how there was an example or an incident where a group of all white visitors came to the Jazz Museum. Could you tell a little bit about that?
Sure. So it was a group that had come from, I can't remember exactly, but it was like somewhere from down south. It was like Tennessee or something like that. And they traveled quite a distance. And the museum, that tour schedule during the summer can get really hectic, and things don't always go according to plan. And so it's a relatively small museum. So we had about four or five tour buses pull up at the same time. And once the museum reaches capacity, you have to, you know, ask people to wait. So this particular group, they were just getting really agitated, frustrated, and they started kind of saying some inappropriate things, and I just felt, in my attempt to handle the situation diplomatically, it wasn't working. You know, the more time went on, the worse the frustration of the group got. And so finally, and I don't even know where it came from, I said, well, it beats being in the belly of a slave ship. And it just got really quiet.
I bet it did.
And then it got, then there was a few people kind of laughed because they didn't know, you know, what I meant. And or they didn't know if I was being serious is a better way to say that. And so I just used that as an opportunity. I said, you know, quite frankly, the American Jazz Museum is not just about celebrating jazz. It's about using jazz as a lens to study African-American history and race relations. And I said, you know, that angst that you're feeling right now, the inability to access a space that you feel you should have access to, that just gives you some small inkling of what it feels like to be a Black person every day. And the conversation shifted dramatically. And even though we weren't in the exhibit yet, people started asking questions about what they could expect in there and how does the Jazz Museum use jazz as a lens for this examination of race relations and what have you. And it just turned into a totally different experience. And once we went through the exhibit, it went from kind of being this adversarial kind of dynamic to one that was very engaging. And when that group left, it was like I had a new group of friends, quite frankly. You know, several of them shook my hand and thanked me for the experience. And one lady pulled me to the side and said, I'm so glad that you said what you said. You know, that's really why we came here, because we were wanting to expand, you know, our horizons as it pertains to these trips that we take. It was a group that took trips to museums and things like that all the time. And so I just thought that was very valuable. And, you know, from that point on, I was less hesitant to talk about those things, as you mentioned earlier, that are difficult to discuss. And with the context of us being in a Black cultural institution, I know this term gets thrown around a lot, but it was a safe space to have a really difficult conversation.
I mean, you knew we were not going to have this topic without the phrase safe space. I mean, yeah. it's a buzz phrase, mm-hmm. but it's an important phrase in a lot of different directions.
Yeah.
And, you know, the group was lucky that they got you
mm-hmm.
and that they got somebody who, even when you said that,
mm-hmm.
I guarantee you some people, okay, speaking for myself, projecting, if the same words would have probably come out with a little bite.
Yeah.
But you have a real gentle spirit that I'm sure made that easy an entree for them to have that conversation.
My friend, you know Natasha Rhea
Elstari. Yes, I do.
Not to say that I'm worthy of this title either, but she calls me the Martin Luther King of poetry. And I do think that it is part of my personality, but I do try to be intentional in that I think there is a time for raised fists and there is a time for anger and righteous indignation. I'm totally on board with that. But I also think that if you're really interested in having a dialogue, that you have to say things in a way that are palatable. And I don't mean biting your tongue or kowtowing or anything like that. But if you do so in a way that invites an exchange as opposed to just an argument, then I think that perhaps there are times, I don't mean to sound overly naive, but a real dialogue can take place that will lead to action or a different way of seeing the world. And that's what I'm interested in.
I mean, that makes sense to me. It's I would imagine that for people who are choosing to come to a Black cultural spot,
right?
Whether it's the Jazz Museum, the Negro League Baseball Museum,
Bruce R. Watkins Cultural Heritage
Center,
the Black Archives.
Exactly. Whether if you're choosing, then already there's some opening you want to have. There's some place you want to get to, or else you would just go to, no disrespect, the Nelson or the Kemper, where you're more likely to feel as if most of the other people there share your cultural background.
Exactly. And so that was one of the points that I made as well, that you'd be surprised at when I was working at the Jazz Museum, I would venture to guess, I would have to go back and look at the numbers, but there were probably more white people that came to the Jazz Museum during my tenure there than Black people.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
And I think that when you look at what was going on with the Kansas City School District during the time that I was there, and I'm so grateful that they're making strides in the right direction. But a lot of the schools in the urban core did not have the luxury of going on a field trip, whereas a lot of the suburban schools did. And so with that being the case, I think the teachers that brought their students there and then the people who came of their own volition, as you said, were hoping to, for the most part, I would say, have a better understanding of Black culture and race relations. And so if they come seeking that, I wanted to provide kind of a welcoming environment as opposed to an accusatory one. Although I have a lot of accusations to hurl, I tried not to do that in that particular space and time. And what I found, and I allude to this in my TED Talk, is that whenever there are parts of our history that are left out intentionally, or parts of our history that are distorted, these institutions offer us an opportunity for a counter narrative. They offer us an opportunity to shed light on aspects of our shared history that you won't find in the history books or that are not being taught in the classroom. And I would oftentimes see white people who were angry that they didn't know certain things about, you know, Black culture in Kansas City. You know, when I was at the archives, I would talk about the fact that at one point in time, the Kansas City Star would not print Black obituaries. They wouldn't print any information about what was going on in the Black community, which is why the Kansas City Call, which was established in 1919, became so important. It became a vital voice in the Black community. There are white people who grew up here who are older than me that didn't know that up until 1955, Black people couldn't move past 27th Street. And it angers them.
Yeah, we're going to continue this conversation. We want to hear from you. How have cultural institutions in town like the Jazz Museum, Mutual Musicians Fund, or the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum changed your understanding of race in Kansas City? Call us at 816-235-2888. We have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Glenn North. Stay with us. Central Standard. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, filling in for Gina Kaufman today. Here with me to continue our conversation about community healing is Glenn North, Director of Public Programs and Events at the Bruce R. Watkins Cultural Heritage Center.
Yes, sir.
And the Poet Laureate for 18th and Vine District, and as I dub him, the Black Culture Savant of Kansas City. Hey again, Glenn.
Hey.
So one of the things that you and I have talked about regarding this subject of cultural institutions as places for, you know, bridging the divide, you know, opening the conversation with, in this context, you know, primarily whites, white people, is there any concern with Black institutions that using the phrase safe spaces, that Black people who visit will feel as if those institutions aren't safe spaces when they visit?
Yes, that does come up. And it's a delicate dance because the topic of race is such a touchy one. There were times when I was working at the American Jazz Museum that I think the surrounding community felt that we oftentimes catered to white interests. But I think it's a matter of perception. I think that Black cultural institutions, I want to be careful how I say this, but they, a majority of them are struggling right now, especially the smaller ones. And oftentimes, for sustainability, there is the need to reach out to the white community, to collaborate with different white institutions, to try to get the kind of support and funding that will help continue the mission. And I do think that there have been conversations that I've heard take place that we have to be careful about what we say. We have to be careful about what we do. I wanted to do a talk, and it was introduced to me by a hip hop artist named Reach, and he was wanting to do a discussion about Black women's hair. And we wanted to do it during Women's History Month. And this was a couple of years ago. And we wanted to title it Straight Versus Nappy. And there was a whole lot of pushback in terms of how would white people perceive that, and you know that.
Or
kind
how
of
would
thing.
Some of us Black people
exactly.
perceive that?
But we wanted it to be kind of provocative, you know. To I mean, we were pushing for that, and sometimes I do want, you know, there to be an edginess to the programming, because programming is such a huge component when it comes to Black cultural institutions. It's not always about the artifacts; it's about people, and so, you know, we had a lot of back and forth, but in that conversation, it wasn't so much what would Black people think about that. It was like, what would white people think about that? And I've had that conversation with some of the administrators that I've had to work with about the white gaze and the white perception, because, you know, a lot of our funders are white. And I would just argue that in a Black institution, we should be afforded the opportunity to be unapologetically Black. And if those white institutions and white philanthropists are funding us, I would hope that it wouldn't be with those kind of strings attached.
Yeah, but I've had to deal with that a little bit myself in a couple of the hats I wear. And I mean, that is an issue. That's for sure. So let's talk to Edward in South Kansas City. Hey, Edward, how are you?
Hey, Michelle.
Oh, so what did you want to either ask or contribute to the conversation?
I'd like to thank both of you for doing this show, first of all, and the insight that Mr. North is giving. And I'd like to talk about or get your opinion on when you know, we don't want people to feel as victims as everyone were enslaved or...
Sure.
were enslavers.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we need to spend more time just educating people as a whole, regardless of their background, because this history is everyone's history.
That's right.
And it has not been represented as such. But I just want to compliment you both for bringing, because the more that these things are discussed, the more that we're able to discuss them amongst ourselves. And I like what Mr. North said about not being unapologetic. At the same time, when he does make a statement that may be militant, perceived as militant, bring it not as an accusation, but just in a way that will, you know, either further the conversation or enrich the conversation. I just wanted to thank you again for the show. And the young man is blessed in his articulation and his presentation. And I just want to thank him. Thank you both again.
Thank you, Ed.
And thank you for that insight that I couldn't agree more. But thank you so much for calling in.
Well, it's funny because I, you know, I'm filling in for Gina because Gina's under the weather. And when I saw what the topics were today, I was like,
it's a setup.
It's like, I know. It's like, actually, I was like, this is sweet. Somebody's going to think that I made Gina sick so I could have this show, because I love these topics, both what we're going to talk about and what we're talking about and what I'm going to be talking with later with some filmmakers. But I do think it's really important for these spaces to do both, to both educate the folks who don't know, but affirm the people who do know.
Yes.
Even if affirming is having a place where you can discuss difficult topics. I mean, I'm sure you've been to the African American history.
No, I haven't had that opportunity.
Oh my God.
So I haven't really fully earned that savant status until I make that
Kansas City.
That pilgrimage.
Right.
Yeah.
No, and when I was there last year, and it looks small from the outside, and you go in and it's enormous. They do it in this real interesting way where the bottom floor of the museum is deep back history, like Middle Passage and slavery and how that took place. And the looks on the faces of the white visitors is just so profound.
Yeah.
It's just so you can just see it having a real, almost physical impact on them.
Right.
And, you know, you get to the top of the museum and it's arts and culture. Mm-hmm. It's the things that black people love to celebrate. That's awesome. You know, music and television and film and poetry and art.
Right.
And there's a part of me that says that we should, and they encourage everybody to come in through the bottom, the bottom floor. And there's a part of me that feels like it should be culturally that people who know the least about history, about black history, have to be forced to start at the bottom and go up.
Right.
And the people who know the most should start with the point of celebration, you know.
No, I get that. And I've heard great things about that museum, and I can't wait for the opportunity to get there. But what I think, you know, just speaking locally, is that Kansas City has an embarrassment of riches when it comes to the black cultural institutions that we have here. And, you know, we talk about the lack of even art and music education in school. I know that we had ample opportunities for students to get that kind of exposure at the Jazz Museum, at the Black Archives. I know that at Bruce R. Watkins, there has been an initiative to do more exhibits with local African-American artists because they need access to spaces where they can exhibit their work and demonstrate their talent. Some of those artists are facilitating workshops for young people. And then, of course, the educational component, because as we all know, you go from slavery to Dr. King, you know, in history, you know, K through 12 pretty much. And there's so much more to mine when it comes to African-American history and the history of people of color. I mean, it's vast and deep. And no matter how much I explore it, there's so much more that I find out that I didn't know. And so I think that it's vital for these museums to provide that service. And I'll just say really quickly that, you know, when you talk about white institutions versus black institutions, it really is about community. Most black cultural institutions can't afford the luxury of just exhibiting objects. We have to be the space where, you know, grandmother who's about to turn 85 needs a space to have a celebration. Yes. We have to be a space where students who don't have activities after school have a place where they can come and hang out and learn. There's so much more, I think, and not to make a false equivocation, but, you know, you look in a space where a church is and you look to see how the community's been impacted by that church. And I think the same is true of Black cultural institutions. If we are fulfilling our mission, the community that we surround should be positively impacted by our presence.
You know, and that's a good segue to our caller, because a lot of what happens with Black institutions are there places to have events,
mm-hmm.
places where people can connect, where there's
yes,
interaction
exactly.
and not just observation.
Right.
So, Tracy, hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Great, great. So there was something you wanted to share with us?
Yes. I just wanted to let the listeners be aware of a cultural event that's happening tomorrow from noon to 1:30 at the UMKC University Libraries. This is the 10th anniversary of our participation in the African American Read-In, which is an event that was put together by the National Council of Teachers of English. And I believe they are celebrating 30 years of this event nationally. It's a celebration of African-American literature and literacy and art and performance. So if folks are interested in attending, it is in room 325 of the Miller Nichols Library.
Well, thank
Wonderful.
You. Thank you for sharing
yeah.
that.
And we participated in that when I was at the Jazz Museum. There were a couple of years where we hosted sessions for the African-American Read-In as well. So that just kind of reinforces the point I was making earlier. There's so much more on the shoulders of a Black institution in terms of really being a resource in the community that it serves.
So I wanted to mention that Greg on Twitter makes a great point about how we're talking about cultural institutions that are for Black spaces,
mm-hmm.
and that there's, you know, a discussion that can also be had about Hispanic and Native American.
Absolutely.
And that's absolutely true. We're talking mainly Black institutions because we're talking about Glenn's TED Talk,
mm-hmm.
which focused on that very specific thing. But,
yeah.
you know, obviously, and to that point, I wanted to point out that a lot of people make the mistake of thinking that all of Black Kansas City history is just right there on 18th and Vine.
Exactly.
You know?
And that's certainly not the case. You know, while we just hosted at Bruce R. Watkins Cultural Heritage Center a meeting for the African American Heritage Trail, which is a partnership with the City Planning Office of Kansas City, Missouri, and other cultural institutions to really look at as many, you know, we want to cast as broad a net as we can to really look at all of the different African-American historical sites, people who were important to Kansas City's African-American history. And let me just say, you know, obviously as a Black person, I'm going to be an advocate for Black culture. But at the same time, I understand that there are so many people that have been disenfranchised. And so injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, as Dr. King would say. And so even when I was at the Jazz Museum, we did an exhibit called Raíces, which is a Spanish word for roots. And we looked at the connection between African and Latino music and African and Latino culture. And that created a space where we could bring in the Latino community to have conversations about the different aspects of their history that needs to be in the forefront. So just, you know, I have to say this sometimes, when I'm an advocate for Black culture doesn't mean that I'm not for anybody else who's in the struggle. That just happens to be the cross that I choose to bear, you know?
That's exactly right. Yeah, no, I totally get that. You know, I did a story a few months ago on the Alliance of Artists of Color,
mm-hmm.
and they make that same point, that
mm-hmm.
while it's primarily Latino visual artists who started
mm-hmm.
the organization, it's for every artist of color.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that sometimes people have to, everyone has to start where they are.
Exactly.
You know, and you're a black artist.
Mm-hmm.
You've worked for black cultural institutions for, I won't say forever, you know, like forever, you know, but, you know, but you've worked, you've worked at a great cross section of organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm sure that's what fueled your TED Talk.
Mm-hmm.
And as we're winding up this conversation, what is it that you think people should most know or think about when they're planning on visiting a black cultural institution and they're not black?
Just to have an open mind, but to also one of the things that I talk about in the TED Talk really quickly is this idea of occupying whiteness that my poet friend Roger Bonaire Agard talked about. And when we talk about privilege, when we talk about access to resources, as I said, there are a large portion of African-American or black cultural institutions that are struggling. So in terms of having an open mind to that experience, I would also hope that they would have an open mind to how they can actively support these institutions without being paternalistic or without the expectation that it would be diluted in some way.
And do you find that as people come to visit and they're trying to learn, and do you find that you have to handle maybe a little bit differently the people who are coming to work out their stuff?
Yeah. So the whole like white guilt and white fragility, there's so many different phrases that are going around now as we talk about, again, another kind of cliche combination of words, diversity and inclusion. And quite frankly, yes, not that I water anything down. That's just not who I am. But, you know, the approach has to be different. The conversation has to be different. And you can feel, you know, like as a black person, you kind of develop a sixth sense. And, you know,
Sixth sense, seventh sense, eighth sense.
Exactly.
Yes.
And you know when you're in the presence of that kind of energy. And I just try to, the best of my ability, use that as a teachable moment as opposed to, you know, succumbing to frustration. Because there have been, as I said, many situations that really started off like, oh, man, this is going to go south pretty quick. And as it turned out, I made a new friend, or I think in some way with my understanding of what to refer to in that space, you know, whether it was an exhibit or an object or a historical anecdote or what have you, that I think has created in a small way some change in that person's way of seeing the world. You know, I would like to think that anyway.
And we both know from the work we've both done over the years that, and this is the thing that I think a lot of white people who mean well don't get, is it's bumpy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's bumpy. It's not a smooth rise. And, and the fear, the constant fear of being accused of being a racist just because you ask a question is just something I think that black institutions are pretty good at not having that energy.
Yeah.
At least that's what I've noticed over the years.
I would agree. We have to learn to be comfortable with the uncomfortable. And that's the only way things are going to change. And if, you know, every morning when you turn on the news and you look at what's going on with the current political climate, this is the best time to be having these kind of conversations, because we see very clearly that America is still racially divided and we can't fix what we aren't willing to face.
Glenn North, thanks so much for joining us today. Glenn is the Director of Public Programs and Events at the Bruce R. Watkins Cultural Heritage Center and the Poet Laureate for 18th and Vine District. After the break, we'll talk to local filmmakers who have worked to preserve parts of Kansas City history that have otherwise been ignored. Stay with us. You know the song, I'm going to Kansas City, Kansas City, here I come. And if you don't know the song, then you've never been out of town. I'm going to be standing on the corner of 12th Street and Vine. That's part of the song. It's a famous song about a street in town that gets overlooked in favor of 18th and Vine, which we just talked about. But two local filmmakers have made a documentary that tells the story of life on 12th Street back in the day.
12th Street was just like a village, I think.
You could feel the love in the air, man, when I grew up on 12th Street.
Anything that we needed, we had access to.
I loved 12th Street.
People were just different.
Everybody knew everybody. We just had fun. We partied together, worked together.
It was basically where people, as black people, we gathered, we lived, we worked together.
And then 12th Street was just, oh man, it was a memorable place. Just always something going on that was funny. People joking and laughing, partying. You couldn't walk down 12th Street hardly on a Friday and Saturday night. You almost had to walk in the streets because the sidewalks would be that loaded with people. I mean, man, you couldn't see nothing but heads and shoulders. That's the way 12th Street was.
Rodney Thompson and Stinson McClendon, good morning.
Good morning.
All right, so which one of you is Rodney? All right, Rodney, and you're Stinson. Okay, right. Great. Sorry. Just want to make sure I'm directing my eyes to the right person. So already I'm sold. The voices were so beautiful and distinct and just so textured the way you do when you talk to real people about real things. Is this a documentary?
I'm sorry, is it about community?
Is it a documentary?
Oh, yes, it's a documentary.
Okay, about how long is it?
It's a little less than an hour.
Great. So what's your focus?
Well, I think one of our primary focuses was to provide a platform for elders who lived in the community, who lived in the vicinity of 12th and Vine, I'm sorry, of 12th Street during the era of the 1940s and 1950s to allow them to share their memories of what life was like in the 12th Street area during that era.
So I'm a playwright also, and I have a play up that deals with the 1940s. And as someone who hasn't lived in the 1940s, what is it that is so unique about that era for black folks in Kansas City?
Well, I think from talking to so many of the era elders, they seem to feel a great sense of community for the 12th Street area, for the community that they lived in at that particular time, and to stress the fact that it's very much different now than it was then.
Stinson, could you tell me, do you know, what did 12th Street just like... Not that I'm saying that you're old enough to know from personal experience, but do you know, what did 12th Street look like?
Well, you bring up an interesting point because there were in doing a documentary, you know, you got to cover the screen. You can write a lot of things. But 12th Street, there weren't that many photographs of 12th Street. We had a real struggle to come up with photographs of the area, because you think about that era, black folks weren't the subject of a lot of coverage, visual coverage, even by the Kansas City Star and the Kansas City Times. There were some photos from Life magazine.
You know, you, that brings up the point that all of us who deal with any kind of history, whether it's like with me, news stories, just trying, you know, a story that's running tomorrow that's about Minnesota Avenue and the desegregation of Minnesota Avenue, and finding pictures, public pictures of what Minnesota Avenue looked like, you know, in the 50s and the early 60s is also very difficult, because we have the privilege these days of having these phones now that photograph everything. So how did you deal with that?
digging deep on the research, trying to explore the Truman Library, the Missouri Valley Room, and the archives of Life magazine and places like that, trying to find photographs. I did run across several photographs of Minnesota Avenue in the 1940s, 50s.
Oh, we'll talk about that after the show. So how did you two come together to work on this? Because you guys are both filmmakers independent of one another, as well as you've done projects together, correct?
Yes.
All right. So how'd you guys come together?
Well, actually, we've known each other since the seventh grade. We went to middle school together and high school together, and actually came back together after college when we found out that we shared this interest in photography and filmmaking. And we had a business together for quite a few years. And then after that, we both started making films independently, and we've worked on a number of projects together.
See, you guys are an example of be careful of the company you keep. You know, some people hang out together, grow up together, and they get into bad stuff. You all, you know, you can be filmmakers.
Yeah, we had a common interest, and that was a visual thing, you know, photography, film.
So history tells us so much about current times, right? Whether you want to think about it that way or not. How do you feel that your film sheds a light on what people are going through today in the Black community in Kansas City?
Well, first of all, Kansas City has a tremendous African-American history. And too often that history has not been told with the same vigor that the history of the entire city has been told. But I think that what it does is to allow people to know what it was like in the past, and to there's a lot that can be learned. We certainly are not trying to go back to those days of total separation and segregation, but I think that we can learn a great deal about what people were like during that particular era and see how that can be applied to today.
So, yeah, I'm sorry, Cindy, you were about to say something?
A lot of the people that we interviewed spoke to that point, that they felt things were better. You know, sometimes that gets kind of smoked over or kind of foggy in history because everything was not as in the good old days.
Right.
But they seemed to have a camaraderie between themselves because of segregation. They all had, a lot of the men had tailored suits because they couldn't shop downtown. A lot of the people worked with each other because they had to work with each other. And so there's some things that you learn that are positive about that experience. And there's some things that are negative in terms of today.
I have heard some version of that from pretty much every older Black person I have ever met, where they talk about how the positives of pre-Jim Crow is that Black people were allowed to thrive and lean on each other and have their own businesses and have Black teachers and have all these role models in a way that was nothing but positive. And that yes, integration is best for all of us, but that something was lost. Did you hear much of that in interviewing people?
Absolutely.
No
from
question.
Practically every person that we talked to, the elders said that integration was the problem.
Mm.
It wasn't something that we expected, but that's what they, so many of them said, that even though we were segregated, even though life was very difficult, in a lot of ways, it was better.
You know, that raises a really good question about the job of, I think, a filmmaker, especially a documentarian, is that you have to lead with your curiosity. I mean, it's very similar to journalism. And so what are some other unexpected things you heard from people in doing this film?
Well, I think that one of the things was that they didn't know that they were experiencing this. I don't know what you would call it. They didn't know what they didn't know. They just dealt with what was in front of them, and they pushed forward, and they just dealt with it.
Sort of like poor people who don't realize they're poor until they move away and get around people who have money.
Right.
Because they were happy, and they had what they needed.
And in the film, one lady, a couple of them say, we had everything we needed.
Man.
But that was in the bigger picture, there was a lot more going on outside of their little circle.
So your film's about to debut somewhere, correct?
Yes.
At the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, Saturday at 2:00.
This Saturday?
Yes.
So what's the theme? Why this Saturday?
Well, because the Nelson was gracious enough to allow us to show the film, and they designated February as the best time for it to happen.
Are you working with Krishan McKinney over there?
Yeah, Krishan McKinney.
She's the best. She's the best. And she's very awesome at making sure that she comes up with events and programs that trigger the conversations that people have. You know, similar to what Glenn North and I were talking in the earlier segment, is your film for the black citizens of Kansas City to get a sense, or is it for everybody in Kansas
City? Our film
City?
Is for everybody. We made a film about 12th Street based on the memories that people were able to share with us. And one of the most important things to me is the fact that these are firsthand accounts of people who lived through this period. These are not scholars commenting and writing about what they have not experienced. These are the actual people that historians call them primary sources.
Yes, they do. They do. Were they? And primary sources are often hard to find. How did you find folks?
Well, when we started, Rod and I had the concept, and I was talking to one of my barber friends guy cuts my hair, and he said, what are you guys doing? I was telling him, working on a project on 12th Street. He said, you know, you need to talk to my wife's aunt, a lady named Miss Bessie Littlejohn. And so I contacted
I'm already there with the name. So you know somebody whose name is Bessie Littlejohn knows some things.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we contacted her, and then she kind of turned us on to a lot of people who were her friends who were from 12th Street, who lived in the area, and that's kind of how the ball got rolling. And those people did have photographs, and some of them had fabulous memories about it, which, you know, lined up historically with what things were like in that time.
That's great. I mean, I'm sure once you find those primary sources, they're really, I want to use the word grateful. Although that was my great-grandmother's word, but who were happy for the opportunity to talk about those times.
Right, the opportunity to tell their stories.
Yeah.
An opportunity that they don't often get based upon their positions in life, you know, just everyday people.
We only have a few more seconds really to talk about this, but just what is the number one thing you would say that distinguishes 12th Street from 18th and Vine?
Well, I think that that was actually one of the primary things that we asked people, and what I took away from it was people, African Americans, are not monolithic. everybody didn't think the same thing about 12th Street or 18th Street. They didn't all agree.
Wow, this has been great. We could talk about this a lot longer. Our time is up. I'm sorry about that. Rodney Thompson, Stinson McClendon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Their documentary, I Remember 12th Street, is screening this Saturday at 2 p.m. at the Nelson Atkins Museum. We also spoke today with Glenn North, Director of Public Programs and Events at the Bruce R. Watkins Cultural Heritage Center, about the ways Black cultural institutions can be sources of healing in a divided community. You can check out both of these conversations at kcur.org/Central Standard later today. That's kcur.org/Central Standard. And talk with us anytime on Twitter at KCURCST. Anyway, Central Standard is produced by Melody Rawl with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and interns Lisa Klockel. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson. Gina, get better. Up to date is next.